How does the MacGyver theme song go?
Is that a question for me? I have no idea.
We're having an argument over here.
We're throwing you right into the hot seat.
What I can tell you is that I won $100 because I was able to sing the entire Gilligan's Island theme song from beginning to end.
I think the MacGyver song's cooler.
The extended version.
There aren't lyrics to the MacGyver theme song, though, are there, Neil?
We can make them up. I'm pretty sure that there's not.
If I would launch right into making them up if I knew the melody. I'm not sure I'm even familiar with the themes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's badass.
I must have always turned it on, like, right after it started, because that's not ringing any bells.
MacGyver is a guy who builds things out of rope.
So you got my email about us just talking about MacGyver all day, right?
Yeah, I did get that one.
Hello, you're listening to episode 15 of The Flyover Effect, a podcast about startups, design, and all things internet. The Flyover Effect is brought to you by BitMethod. You can learn more about us at bitmethod.com. I'm Scott Rocketship, your producer and frequent co-host. Also in this episode, you'll be hearing from our CEO, Dan Shipton, our senior software engineer, Neil Roberts, and we're chatting with Alex Hillman. He's the co-founder of Indie Hall, a co-working community in Philadelphia, and recently began working on the Beanstalk and Postmark apps for WildBit. You can find Alex online on Twitter at AlexKnowsHTML, or on his blog at dangerouslyawesome.com. We chat about community management, going on safari to find your customers, and what the real world can learn from building online communities, and vice versa. Enjoy the show.
Well, I think the least obvious part is the fact that there was a sort of a non-business relationship prior to, I've been working with the company since December of last year, but for several years prior to that, I've just been good friends of Chris and Natalie, and done some work with them as like freelance stuff when they were still doing sort of design consulting projects. But they're one of those companies that managed to make the transition from being a design consulting company to making their own products and having the products entirely self-sustain them. And so that's probably the most interesting thing is, so like I was one of like the first dozen or so beta testers of Beanstalk before it was a paid available SaaS service. And I didn't realize that until I joined the company and I was able to log in and go back through the account records and go, oh, look, there's me from 4.5 years ago.
How did you end up starting Indie Hall and kind of building that community?
Yeah, so back in 2006, I was a freelance web developer working in Philadelphia out of my apartment, and was sort of looking around and going, where are the people that I can hang out with that do this kind of work, or anything even remotely like this work? And that was really challenging, to the point where it was actually easier to find people that did the kind of work that I did in what felt like any other city on the planet than my own backyard. And sort of a twist of fates, I suppose, led me to meet Chris Messina and Tara Hunt. And I guess Tara was your first guest on this show, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I met Tara and Chris when they had started Citizen Agency back in, I guess, 05, 06 or so. And Citizen Agency led to Citizen Space as well, as they needed their own office. And that was one of the first sort of dedicated co-working spaces. That was sort of Chris's battle cry was they just put, plugs. Now they plugged up the power outlets at Ritual Roasters. What do we do now? Let's open Citizen Space. And so I was sort of inspired by that and inspired by a lot of what Chris and Tara did and said, well, maybe I should go work with these people. And unfortunately, that plan didn't pan out quite the way we expected, but it did give me an opportunity to introspect and think about, why was I trying to leave Philly again? Oh, right, because it was hard to find people. Well, if it's hard for me to find people, it's probably hard for everybody to find people. So maybe I should just find some people and put in that work. And if it works for me, I can help other people find other people. Well, that'll be good for Philadelphia. And then a bunch of things happen and sort of fast forward or back to the future style for a second. And I meet a business partner, Jeff DeMasi, who is just this amazing dude with awesome experience in everything from education to civic organization and design and real estate and community and all of these things that I really didn't have a lot of experience with. And we just aligned on the fact that Philadelphia deserved better in terms of sort of a self-aware creative and technology community, and that having a place could probably help, you know, something like the Citizen Space co-working thing that at the time was still pretty early in the stages of co-working becoming the phenom that we know it as today.
Did you start out kind of assembling a group of people and then finding a space, or
that's
the impression
that
I'm getting?
That's absolutely it. Yeah, we worked for about 9 months doing anything we could from anywhere we could. You know, we would do like the Jelly style casual co-working thing, from bars or restaurants, anywhere that had Wi-Fi and wouldn't toss us out. And when it got to the point where we had some critical mass, it was like 20 or so people that were getting together every week or two. I said, you know, we could do this all the time if we had our own clubhouse. It's going to cost a little bit of money, but you know, you can tell me how much you can afford and how much you'd want to use it. And we were able to sort of back into a business model that was actually sustainable instead of trying to develop a business model to sustain a space that we would then need to find people to sell it to.
How did you recruit? I mean, did you kind of put it up on Twitter, or did you have a network of people you went to?
I definitely was using Twitter a lot, but at the time that, like, Twitter works when people know you're there. And it was sort of that cold start problem where I was looking for people, but nobody was really looking for me, or at least they didn't know they were looking for me. So I really sort of, I had to walk out the front door and go meet people. And I would just like scour calendars and lists and find places where people were gathering to talk about tech and creative and business and you know, whatever user groups online or off I could find, I was there. And so it was sort of like, you know, it was several months of me sort of blitzing my way through what ecosystem already existed and sort of navigating all the fragmentation and sort of learning my way around and who the people were and looking for common familiar faces. And the more I found, the more excited I was about who I might find next.
I like, Alex, it seems to me like you're almost kind of honing your message a little bit. There's been, I think a lot of people look to you as a, you know, kind of the co-working guy or a co-working leader. And the word that gets thrown around a lot with co-working is community. And what I've been hearing more from you lately is the word relationship. You had a great blog post up about that recently. Listening to the Founders Talk episode that you did, you went on at length about, you know, doing some of this recruitment and just like this kind of person-to-person interaction, how that's missing from business. And it's wonderful. It's good stuff. And it's obviously works for, you know, this kind of egalitarian, you know, co-working sort of vibe where everybody's in this together. And I'm really curious how you find yourself applying these lessons now in like, hey, we're going to make money with this. Like I need to use these skills now at a product company and put this to work for me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a great point. And that's actually probably been the most fun about the transition is sort of having to think what have I learned from these skills? What are the core assets I've built for myself? And I think there's a couple of tools that have become really valuable. One is the sort of human behavior pattern recognition skill that I don't think anyone's really born with it. I think it just takes a lot of practice and to learn and sort of figure out where people are gathering and how to approach those gatherings so as to not disturb them, but actually become an active contributor and part of these gatherings. So do you guys know Amy Hoy from Slash 7 and Freckle and all that jazz?
I know of her.
Yeah, so Amy has taken and run with a class that her and I initially put together. The goal was to help people build their first product-based business. And the goal of our class was not to teach them everything about how to build a product-based business, but how to do everything leading up to launch day so that your first user is also your first customer. And one of the concepts that Amy's really, really tuned in terms of language to describe this process that I go through, that she goes through as well, is this idea of going on a safari. And where you really have to like going on a safari, you don't sit in one place and wait for the animals come to you. You have to like go out in a truck and drive around in the hot desert where it's probably uncomfortable. And eventually you'll find a watering hole that's surrounded by animals and you can look at them and take pictures and all those sorts of things. And you actually might find multiple watering holes before you find the animals you're looking for. And so this sort of community element is the same thing where I think people expect community to be sort of a set up shop and it'll just show up. And instead, if you treat it more like a safari where you really need to go out and scout and look for people that might really value being around each other that don't know about each other yet, and then a lot of times my role becomes being a connector as well. I guess the key is that in terms of sort of the community building translation from the co-working stuff to the product stuff is we can't expect to know that our customer is going to come around us. In fact, the fact that Beanstalk has grown as big as it has, largely due to word of mouth and, you know, just a great reputation, the seemed like the best way to turn that on was to go out and figure out where people were already talking about and using Beanstalk that we didn't know about, that we hadn't heard, and then we could help connect to all of those circles together and amplify the message that was being told just directly from our customers' mouths.
How are you finding or identifying with either experience, with now at WildBit or with IndieHall, people who maybe don't self-identify as needing what you have available? That's something that we've been talking about a lot in our local community in Des Moines. Of, you know, we wised up pretty quick that the build it and let them come model doesn't work. But going on Safari has been difficult for us as well to push the metaphor, because we'll find lions and they don't know that they're a lion, right? Right. Like they're not aware that that's what they are. We were just at a user experience happy hour. A local gentleman is trying to get just people who maybe identify themselves as connected to usability and user experience together. And it's just tough. You know, we know that those folks are out there, but it's not something that they identify with.
Well, maybe the problem is it's a communications issue, and the fact that they have a different word they use to describe it. That's probably the biggest challenge when you're going out into these communities is, you know, you mentioned the community is a word that gets thrown around a lot. I think authenticity is another one too, mm-hmm. where people think they're being authentic, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're speaking in the same vocabulary. So they're being authentic for them, but they're sort of a vocabulary mismatch. And that's a really hard challenge to get over. And I think that any time I've been able to successfully get over that hump has been me finding, you know, one of these groups of people and just really taking the time to learn and listen and study and figure out how they talk and what their priorities are and what they care about and what language they use to communicate amongst themselves. Those are the types of things that you learn from real quickly and become assets in terms of being able to participate authentically. Because I guess the best way to really think about it is, you know, if you're at like a cocktail party and you're just walking up into people's conversations, introducing yourself and then taking over the conversation, even if you're, you know, even if what you want to talk about is authentic, it doesn't necessarily mean it's what they want to talk about or the way they want to talk about it. So, yeah. You know, there's some element of social graces to be learned here as well.
I think we see that a lot with, we've got a designer and she's on a mission to like connect designers and programmers, and more specifically, like get designers into our community by showing them that it's not so hard. And she's a designer herself. She tries to do that education, the finding common ground between the two. And, it's been really hard for her. At the same time, she's had a lot of success in a short period of time.
There's also, I think there's an element of recognizing people that are willing.
Yeah.
And really capitalizing on low hanging fruit. I think, you know, IndieHall was largely a right place, right time success. I mean, our continued success has been a lot of work, but I think that there were people looking for the thing that we were interested in creating. And so often I'm watching people build software products for customer bases that would never pay for them. Not to say that the software product idea is a bad idea. It's just that the audience they're building for would never spend a dime on it, because they don't spend a dime on anything. And people don't consider what other people do. They only consider what other people say. And when you go out and you ask people questions, they'll tell you one thing. And the trick is to sort of look through what they say for what they mean, and better yet, what they do. Sort of like the Henry Ford adage, you know, if I had given people what they asked for, I would have given them a faster horse or something of that nature. So, you know, being able to look past what people say they want or how they respond for what they actually feel or need is another value. And trying to spend all of your energy convincing people that they want something of yours is a lot of energy and it's a lot of work. And I much prefer to find things that people already want and help them realize why what I have does what they want.
I've definitely found that to be true. And the hard thing for me is remembering that in every use case, right? Because it's like, oh, like I know that, and then I'll use it correctly once, and then some other problem presents itself. It's like, oh, geez, how do I solve this? I got to tell people they want it. Alex, I think you had a chance to tour a little kind of art-based co-working space in Des Moines that I used to run called Market Street Media Foundry.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And some folks and I had started running it, and I had it backwards. We really were like, everyone was telling us they needed space and that they needed they wanted a spot where they could come and work together. And we're like, well, okay, that sounds pretty doable. You know, we found some very inexpensive space and we built it. We had a few folks on board and just life got a hold of them and they had to step away early on. And then it's like, okay, well, where's everybody else that was telling us they needed space? And, you know, when push came to shove, they're like, maybe that's not really what I want. Real estate's cheap here. I can work in my garage. I've got a massive spare bedroom I can work in. I've got an attic or whatever, whatever. And what we had been doing also had started was a monthly art market for folks to get together and sell their goods. And it was highly curated and just kind of created something that we sensed they needed. And that's been a phenomenal success. We're running that for 3 years now. We shut down the space. We're still running the market. And that's got a life of its own. And it's accomplishing a lot of the same goals. But it was, you know, we had to listen to people, but not really trust what they were telling us.
Yep. Right. Yeah. And that's just it. I mean, so a great example is, you know, we're looking at new feature development, things that are already in our existing pipeline for Beanstalk, as well as our other product, which is Postmark. And if you want to talk about that, we can talk about that a little bit more. But Beanstalk in particular has a fairly large customer base and an even larger potential customer base. And one of the interesting conversations that I have a lot is, you know, people look at us and they go, oh, you guys are like GitHub. And I go, well, yeah, except Git is, you know, less than 10% of our repo base. We're still largely Subversion. And the more people I talk to, the more I realize that Git's awesome. And we use Git for just about everything, at WildBit. And I use it for lots of things personally. But the vast majority of the software development world doesn't. And the terrifying thing is that the vast majority of the software world doesn't use any version control. Yeah. And so when people say, who is your primary competition? Is it GitHub? I say, well, GitHub's doing really well. We really like those guys. In fact, we use them when we open source our stuff as well. But our biggest competition is the people who aren't already using version control and figuring out what are the reasons they're not adhering to those needs. So a big part of my work in the last few months in particular has been finding places online and off where people that could be our customers are hanging out and, you know, asking questions or sort of, you know, poking the hornet's nest once in a while and saying, so why aren't you guys using version control yet? And you get any myriad of excuses or reasons, however you want to classify it. And we've learned so much about these people that aren't customers yet that helps us sort of tweak and tune our product roadmap to build things that are going to be widely, widely useful, not just popular, but the things that are actually going to make people's lives better, because we were able to get sort of an aggregate set of information of the pain people were expressing about why they didn't use version control. And that process has been really, really cool to go through. And obviously through it, we get to meet lots of people. And what I'm excited about is in 6 months or whenever we get to implement some of these new tools and features into Beanstalk, being able to go back to those people that I met in those interactions, some of whom I took the time to one-on-one, you know, show them a couple of my favorite places to learn about how to use version control, or, you know, here's my favorite screencast, or, you know, Beanstalk just launched our guides section, which is sort of our take on the one of the big things that we heard in the why aren't you using version control is it's too hard to learn. And so you have to go one step further than that. And I go, well, why is it too hard to learn? And people say things like, well, the documentation is really ugly.
Yeah.
And you take a step back from that and you go, you don't want to learn it because the documentation is really ugly. Well, WildBit happens to be a company that's well known for making really beautiful, elegant software. You know, why don't we have this really beautiful, elegant guides? As luck would have it, project was actually going on long before I joined the company. One of our designers was like, we should have really beautiful, elegant guides to the basics of how to use version control. And it's better than just tutorials. It's, you know, stuff that's going to help you understand and some best practices and things like that. So, you know, being able to point people that I'm, you know, very short term, I can get a little bit out of them about what hurts. I can say, well, here's a resource we've already built. Let me know if this helps you get one step further. And whether they do or don't, I've immediately found out something about our guides aren't good enough, or our guides are awesome for a person who struggled with this thing in the past. And then whatever it's going to take to get them to the next level where they're going to be like, I need version control in my life. Well, we can be there with Beanstalk. So that's those are the sorts of it's playing a little bit of a long game. Back to your point earlier about you know, the relationship building. I'm not jumping into these designer developer communities trying to sell them on Beanstalk. I'm trying to sell them on a way to be a better at whatever it is that they do. And sort of the Kathy Sierra, you know, make your users feel like they can kick ass. That's what I want to do. I want to find people that are already doing great work, and I want to help them level up. And I want to hope that Beanstalk becomes part of that leveling up. And if not, quite frankly, that's okay too. Because if nothing else, when somebody else needs to level up, that person will recommend Beanstalk as the place where they learned a little bit from.
I think this approach of like going out and finding out what's wrong with people and what they want and their desires is reflected a lot in this new sort of customer support that companies are doing a lot of. What's interesting for me, like hearing you explain how you ended up with Indie Hall, is I'm always thinking about all these things that are happening online should have kind of parallels in the real world. And the whole kind of customer support people are doing now, I feel like I haven't seen that in the real world. And with what you're talking about with Indie Hall, it seems like it should be happening more in the real world. You know, you were successful going out and figuring out what people needed and figuring out that they needed each other in the same way that customer support is starting to do that online nowadays.
Right. Yeah, I think, I mean, so a couple of things in that sort of like online, offline transition idea. One thing that I've talked about before is the fact that if you sort of examine a co-working space, it feels like a real-world manifestation of a forum, of like a really popular or well-moderated web forum. Because you've got lots of different people there for a vague but common interest, but they bring their differences to that place. And then anyone can start a new thread, anyone can jump into another thread. Invariably, there's off-topic memes pop up, relationships form, you go personal message with somebody, maybe you spin off a new website. I mean, those are the sorts of things that happen in really healthy forum online communities. And it's really cool to me to sort of notice the parallels in a healthy co-working space from that sort of online mechanism that we sort of learned how to operate that way in. And to your point of customer service coming offline as well, my hope is that it's only a matter of time. But to sort of tie the things that we've been talking about together, the sort of proactive customer support style of work I'm doing at WildBit, as well as the things I'm doing at Indie Hall, all being about that relationship building. My hope is that more places like Indie Hall expose people to this style of interacting with other people, whether they're customers or not, and that, you know, WildBit or co-working spaces like Indie Hall, what we're really doing is helping teach like the next generation of people that will need to support other people that there's a better way to be doing it. So like I would like things to be better now, but I know that if we keep working diligently at the things that we're doing today, that the impact that it'll have on sort of the business world in, you know, 10 or 15 years will be much more profound.
Why do you think these companies that are starting to experiment with more proactive customer support have taken so long to kind of figure that out?
Up until recently, they were able to hide, I think, was the big thing. You know, the internet made it way too easy for people to call a company out on their poor service practices.
Yeah.
And prior to that, you know, companies were able to pretend it wasn't a problem. Now it's being thrown in their face. Every little thing that goes wrong is a potential PR nightmare, and the last thing they want is that. So I think there's an element of fear that's pushing people into, well, we need to be more proactive because otherwise people out there will, you know, say bad things about us.
Yep.
I also think that there's an element of just that the tools are better. You know, and because the tools are better, we're also learning how to use them better. You know, we made the transition to using Assistly at WildBit. And the difference that made in terms of how much support we were able to do in a smaller period of time and without degrading the quality of the support at all is remarkable. So good tools that actually think about how humans interact with other humans makes a huge difference. You know, the tools that continue to train people to deal with support and communication in this sort of transactional manner are going to continue perpetuating this transactional, you know, triage style support. But the tools that teach you how to be proactive and teach you how to do that more efficiently are going to teach people good habits. I think that's a great thing.
The trend I really enjoy is seeing how the concept of support has moved more into what can we help you with? Just a general, flat, open, what can we help you with, as opposed to what's wrong?
Yep.
What's broken? What's, you know, what's not working for you? I mean, right. If you think back, I don't know, not too long ago, a lot of, and still today for many companies, just even a technology product, consumer level product, like you have to go, you know, you'd have to go through the phone tree and just, you know, you'd have to make 18, 20 decisions on what exactly your problem was about. And if it didn't fit into their box and their little support mold, then you couldn't get any help with it.
And there sure as heck wasn't a form or an option on the phone to go, you guys are doing a good job. I'd love to see X. Mm-hmm.
Oh, you just hit the nail. So I have to give my team at WildBit, like, they're the ones that deserve all the credit, because I'm the joker that came in, you know, a few years down the road and made it my job to go out and find all of our customers and figure out what they were saying about us. And as luck would have it, our customers love us. I mean, WildBit's customers are amazing, and the things that they say about us and our products are, I mean, it's the sort of thing that it makes me really, really excited to meet a WildBit customer, just because I can't wait to hear what great thing they have to say about our products. And the really cool part is, because I'm having those interactions outside of the scope of typical support and triage, is I'm getting a much more natural response from people about how they really think about a product. And when people use emotional words like love and awesome and amazing and happy and makes my day, and like, those are the ways people describe Beanstalk and Postmark unprovoked. And then you give them an opportunity to riff on that and just, you know, stand back. It's crazy. So, you know, we did our company retreat back in April, and everybody did a little secret project off the radar of everybody else. And, you know, the designers would design something, the developers would develop something, and I was like, what the heck do I do? And so I went through all of the correspondence that I had and looked for the words love and awesome. And then I did sort of a poetry slam style reading of email quotes and tweets of the sort of positive things people say about our products, just so the rest of the team had a chance to hear them. And it was really cool to sort of, you know, have our team experience that. And it was really cool to sort of be the messenger for that. I feel like the luckiest guy in the world when, you know, I had very little to do. I had nothing to do with building these awesome products. And especially when I got started, and now I get to be on the receiving side of the, you know, some of the fondest compliments I've ever heard. It's a remarkable experience when customers are given the opportunity to say thank you or something nice just because. That's awesome.
Yeah, so you mentioned that a lot of these companies are starting to do this out of fear, but I almost feel like there's no way for a company to really be proactive about this type of support and not feel infectiously good from it.
No, I think you're totally right.
Like, it just seems like if you're out there looking for problems, then just the fact that you're able to help someone that might not have asked for help, or you're going to see the people saying that they love it and that it's awesome. Like, you don't have a chance to have any of that if you're not being proactive about your customer service.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's an entirely different emotional level to come across something unsolicited, to come across something that you had no hand in creating, shaping, influencing, suggesting, whatever, and people out there are just saying positive things about something you've done or worked on. Like, I mean, that's indescribably better than, you know, like, I love getting emails directed to us and people saying kind things and commenting on our blog posts. But when you look out there and you just find something in the wild, it's like discovering gold. I mean, it's just incredible. Good vibes.
Well, so we've talked about community building for, you know, regional communities and things like that. And there's some element of community development going into what we're doing, or what I'm doing at WildBit as well, and trying to connect our customers with our other customers. I think that's what community development is really about, is finding ways to connect people with other people. It's not about WildBit. It's about WildBit's customers and making sure that they know about each other. And if there's ways they can help each other, then that's even more exciting. I love when people are building tools on Beanstalk's API and I get to share those things with other customers. That's a really cool experience. But I'm going on like a crazy tangent, crazy third tangent, as a spin-off of what the work that we're doing at Indie Hall. We've been thinking about growth and what growth means to us. And our office, our workspace, has been pretty full all summer long. This has been our best year ever, which has been just amazing. Lots of new faces, lots of amazing new people, and lots of interesting activities, and things are sprouting up all over the place. And so rather than just add more desks, we decided to think real hard about what growth could look like for us. And so we decided to build a house. For all of the great things that we've been able to experience and we've learned from building this awesome social place to work and the impact that can have on an ecosystem, what we want to learn is what translates into creating a place to live and how that impacts the neighborhood that you live in and how that impacts how you live in that neighborhood. We're working with some really awesome development partners, this company called PostGreen that does really just rad urban. Their terminology is ridiculously efficient. That's their spin on green sustainability. And working with them and one of their design partners, this architecture firm called Digsaw, that does just amazing design work. And we're going to build a 6-apartment sort of mini apartment complex based on co-housing and sort of blending what we've learned from the co-working experience and the community experience with the desire to, you know, make an impact in a neighborhood and how we experience a neighborhood. And we, if all goes as planned, we bought a piece of land in June and we'll be breaking ground in probably December or January. And then I'll be moving in as soon as it's done.
Sounds awesome.
I'm stoked to be sharing more about that as we move forward, and people can check that out on the website. It's just a house.indiehall.org.
Well, we've got no doubt over here that that's going to be successful too. You got a nice track record for it, and you know, as much as they may try, people can't live on the internet. So this is definitely a new experience, and hopefully you can bring some lessons back from co-housing back into the web. It'll be pretty exciting to see what you learn. So best of luck.
Yeah, it should be good. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much for being on the podcast, Alex. I think that's it for today. Yes, fellas?
Thanks. Yeah.
All right.
Thank you. It was good to catch up with you guys.
Thanks, Alex.
All right. Take care.